Let's return to our conversation with Philippe Dietrich about his young adult novel, Playing for the Devil's Fire.
And so these characters, especially these boys and the family, they really can't get any traction with the officials of the town and those who are in charge. And their parents are gone, so they're lost. And then appears a wrestler.
Stand up tall, that's what they said. Then they said, don't let it go to your head. Meet me on the landing. Somebody's gotta be the last man standing.
And he's a bit of a substitute for Bully's father, but at the same time, he's kind of a pitiful character too. And contrasting that with the grandmother, who's in her own world some of the time, but moves in and out of that world. Would you set the next scene up for us? I really do like the juxtaposition between the grandmother, who up until the point where the wrestler comes in, she's kind of out of it. She's really living in a past world. She seems to be suffering a little bit from dementia, but she steps up too. She gets her wits about her at certain times.
Bully's grandmother suffers from a little dementia, and I think that they enable that. The family enables that. And when she's left alone in the novel, at one point, she's never left alone in the house, and at one point they leave her alone and she disappears. And Bully goes looking for her, and finds her at the end of the town waiting for the bus in the rain because she wants to go back to Veracruz, which is the town where she grew up. She was somebody from an upper middle class or upper class family in Veracruz and fell in love with somebody that the father disapproved of. And so she moved to Mexico City and eventually they moved to Isayoc. So Bolly's coming home and sees two men beating up someone outside a cantina.
This is the part where they pick up the wrestler.
Right. Bolly had seen the wrestling at the feria, at the fair. And that was that. To go to the wrestling, he had to leave his grandmother alone. And his grandmother ended up packing her bag and going out to the bus stop to wait for the bus to go to Veracruz. And that's where Bully goes out looking for her, and he finds her sitting on her suitcase waiting for the bus to Veracruz in the rain. So Bully's coming home with her that night, and they see somebody getting beat up outside a cantina. The man on the ground rolled over and struggled to push himself up. The other man kicked him again. Then the Corona sign flickered, and I saw the red mask. The man on the ground was Chicano Estrada.
No! No!
Chicano was alone. He needed help. But there was no one around. A taut wire of fear traveled down my throat. I had to do something. He was one of the good guys. He had to be. Besides, it was two against one. I didn't think about it. I ran as fast as I could. Everything I had bottled up inside, it all exploded in a flash of rage. I charged from behind and slammed the man on the lower back. His body arched and flew forward. He tripped on Chicano and fell face first on the wet sidewalk. I released Chicano and charged again, just like in the Santo movies. I threw punches, right, left, as fast as I could, one after the other. Let me go. The man in front laughed. He picked up his hat, ran his hand over his wet hair, and put it on.
¿Cómo te gusta, moscoso?
He stepped forward and threw a long hook. His fist sank into my stomach. Everything went black.
This is a kind of facsimile of a wrestling match, right? And Bully's the hero of his own story.
Well, he had come from the wrestling and he's now in it. He'd been talking about wrestling and threw himself in it and didn't do very well.
No. This is Arts and Letters. We're talking with Philippe Dietrich about his novel, Playing for the Devil's Fire. Could you tell us a little bit about the mythologies around wrestling and wrestlers, and then why you chose to have a wrestler appear to attempt to save the day.
Well, because it's Mexico, and the wrestlers are the superheroes in Mexico. I love the wrestlers. I grew up with the wrestling movies of Santo and Blue Demon and Mil Máscaras. And these were classic movies, very campy B movies, but back then we were riveted by them.
No es solamente una máscara, es la máscara, la original.
Portala con orgullo. Ella te guiará hacia un futuro fantástico.
And wrestling in Mexico has a big place, and it's part pantomime, it's a show. It's good versus evil. There are rudos and técnicos, which are the wrestlers that either follow the rules or don't follow the rules. You know, basically good guys versus bad guys. It's very elaborate. And there are little fairs that go around the towns. And one of the things that they do sometimes is put up wrestling matches. And people just love them. And so this was a big part of what I wanted to bring to the story. And Chicano, you know, he's not a good guy, but he's not really a bad guy. He's a School of Hard Knocks kind of guy. And he's somebody from the streets who found his way through wrestling and certainly doesn't want to be there with Boli and help him and get involved with trying to do the right thing. But Boli really pushes for that.
It's a morality play. El Chicano Estrada, he drinks. He's left behind by the rest of the wrestlers. He never takes off his mask, which I love. And he appears, and in some ways, Boli takes care of him as much as he takes care of Boli.
Meet me on the landing. Somebody's gotta be the last man standing.
Exactly, and they both change throughout the story. For Boli, it brings home his worship of El Santo and the other wrestlers of the golden age of Mexican wrestling. But like you said, he becomes a father figure. But he's not perfect, and Boli can see that and has to really convince him. And I think he pulls Chicano out of his shell. You know, he changes Chicano and things happen.
But this is more, I think, than just a narrative of good and evil. It's more than a morality play like you would find in a wrestling ring. It's a lot more complex.
Right. And that's one of the reasons why Chicano is the way he is. He adds another layer of gray to what is good and what is evil. You know, Boli trusts him completely. And even when Boli knows that Chicano's not 100% there on his side or 100% good, Boli never falters in trying to convince him and show him the right path and to help. And Chicano does his thing. He steps up to the plate as best he can through the process.
And it's interesting when you said he thinks about Santo and the golden age of wrestling. This kind of harkens back to the golden age of the town, too.
And it also goes back to my feeling when I'm writing the story, is that nostalgia that we spoke about earlier, that there was a sense of hope and love in that environment. The Mexico that I grew up with had its layers, but it was an innocent Mexico, granted I was a kid, and that's what I wanted to bring back.
So the first section of the book, or what I'm looking at is the first part, before the wrestler appears, you see that kind of as setting up the scene, but in some ways a bit like the match for the Devil's Fire.
You're right about the setup of the match for the Devil's Fire. Becomes a metaphor for this continuous battling that happens. The wrestling match at the Feria, and Boli fighting these two guys outside the cantina to help Chicano.
No.
And then their battle to find his parents and fight the bad guys. It's just this continuous escalation, if you will, of the stakes. What started as a battle for a little marble becomes this long battle for saving the town, finding his parents, keeping his innocence, and so on.
Right, and I like when you say innocence, because as any kid watching wrestling begins to recognize, it's fake, it's not real, and he wishes it was, I think, desperately, but probably in some ways knows, or hopes against hope, it'll end up well, and the one who stands the high moral ground will overcome evil, but I'm not so sure if he truly believes it.
He's trying to believe it, that's for sure. We saw Mosca. He was running toward us, a couple of other guys from school.
Boli, let's go.
We met at the corner. They studied Chicano up and down.
Vámonos, Boli.
He's staying with me. We're going to find out what happened to my parents.
Well, you better come with us. They say there's a couple of people hanging from the pedestrian overpass.
My parents, my dead parents, hanging like laundry from the overpass. Did you see them? Did you recognize him?
No, we're on our way now. Come on.
We ran up Avenida Porvenir, my legs pushing me forward faster than I'd ever run.
Vamos.
We rushed between the food stalls by the side of the old highway and pushed through a big crowd that had gathered at the foot of the overpass. There were people on both sides of the highway. Two men hung from the bridge, one beside the other, but they weren't hanging from their necks. They hung from a foot, their heads at the bottom, so they looked like a pair of tilted Ys.
Why won't anyone bring them down?
Chicano, you have to do something. People stared at Chicano. No one spoke. A vulture landed on the overpass. There's no one else. This is why you stayed, no? The people around us heard me say it. Everyone stared at him, waiting. I could see the pleading in their eyes. We all needed someone to take charge, to do something. There's someone's relatives, maybe someone's father, someone's son. No matter who it was always someone's parents, someone's children. And the way they were hanging, it was disgraceful. It wasn't just murder. It was so much more. It was grotesque, humiliating. It angered me more than death.
To me, that's one of the most powerful scenes in the book. The humiliation, the way that the townspeople are deliberately manipulated, and the lack of humanity.
When you read the stories in the Mexican news in particular about the body parts that are found, how these people are found is beyond death. And I wanted to make that really clear that that is what happens. Writing messages on body parts and dumping them in different places.
He realizes, thankfully, it's not his parents, but it might as well be.
Right. That's a connection to what we talked about earlier about the whole town. To him, the town and the townspeople are his home. So, yeah, they're not his parents, but they're somebody's parents.
Let's hear what happens when Chicano attempts to take down the bodies on the bridge.
Chicano, go. Take them down. You have to. No one else is going to do it. He looked at me. He looked over the crowd. Another vulture floated past and landed near the middle of the bridge, closer to the bodies. Finally, Chicano nodded. He took a deep breath and adjusted the eye holes of his mask. The crowd parted, and he marched up the steps. The vultures on the other side of the overpass slipped away and then took flight only to land on the other side of the bridge. Chicano reached the first person. He knelt, grabbed the rope, and with his giant strong arms, pulled him hand over hand like a sailor. He stood still, holding the rope, and raised the body over the rail. It was a struggle. Then he took the dead man in his arms and laid him gently on the ground. Chicano did the same with the other body. He pulled the rope and then grabbed the body and knelt as he laid it next to the other one. When he stood, everyone at the bottom of the bridge cheered. I nudged Mosca. The people moved forward and climbed the steps. It was as if they had been released from a spell. Someone yelled that they get the undertaker for the bodies. A group of workmen broke through the crowd. They picked up the dead men and carried them away. A woman ran up to Chicano and hugged him. Men shuffled and lined up to shake his hand. He looked at me and smiled. Everyone was reaching for Chicano to thank him and blessing him for what he had done. He held his head up high like he just won a match against Santo or something. You're a hero.
For real. For real.
He is a hero, right? At that moment.
At that moment, he is, and I think that's something that affects him dramatically.
You do get the sense that if they could stand up all together as a collective force, maybe it would work out.
Yes, and what they needed was somebody to take the lead, and he did for that moment, and everybody reacted. And again, it goes back to the wrestling because he represents a hero, right? I mean, he still has his mask and the people see him as such. And he's done something that maybe they feel that they couldn't do. But now they have a leader, although they don't have him for long in the sense that he is not all in. After dinner, I pulled out a videotape where I had recorded the movie Santo contra los Zombies. You could beat Santo, I'm sure of it. You could beat Joaquin and Pedro and Sopilote, all of them. In the Santo movie, Dr. Sandoval's daughter goes to the police because her father disappeared. Just like it happened with my own parents. When they can't find any clues, they end up getting Santo's help. I had Chicano's help. The zombies Santo fights in the movies are dead criminals who come back to life. They weren't monsters, just regular people, ugly and invincible. At the end of the movie, after Santo had saved Dr. Sandoval's daughter and eliminated all the zombies, he said something that made me think of Isayuk.
Por ambición, por riquezas y por poder. Cuando los hombres desafían las leyes de Dios, caen víctimas de sus propias maldades.
When men defy God's laws, he said, they fall victim to their own evil.
It's a great moment. And I just so like that Bully imagines he's in a movie, knows he's not, knows life isn't a movie, but hopes against hope that it's going to turn out.
He does. He does. And you know, you can see that he is picking up on the philosophy of the movie or the sections that he cares about in the movie that can help him with that hope.
And when you say they fall victim to their own evil?
In the movie, it's about the manipulation of these zombies that they bring them back to life. In the story, in Playing for the Devil's Fire, it's about how the narcos themselves become victims of their own evil.
Santo. Siempre hace lo mismo. Nunca espera ni siquiera que le den las gracias.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock. You've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to actors Carlos Retta, Brian Reyes, Jesus Reyes, and Luis Gutierrez. Thank you to musicians, singers, and songwriters Phil Davis of New Motto, David Ramirez, Know Who's a Robot, Bark, and Kinder Funken. A special thanks to Ancient River for the amazing score. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to writer Philippe Dietrich for providing us a moral without moralizing, showing us a kind of reality that transcends stereotypical fiction, and for allowing us to believe that the good guys can sometimes become kings of the marble world. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Roberto Bolano. We interpret life at moments of the deepest desperation.